And our sermon text is Psalm 100. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him. Bless his name. For the Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. What precisely is it that should prompt us to give thanks to the Lord? That we have plenty of food in the pantry and we're making a good salary? That we have a beautiful spouse and a fat and happy set of children? That we're healthy and strong, free of COVID and other physical plagues? Well, certainly we should be thankful for all of these things. But what about when none of these things are present in our life? What happens to a thankful heart then? William Bradford and our Pilgrim fathers knew this to their bones at Plymouth Colony in the winter of 1621 to 22. When a poor harvest and bad business partners deprived them of needed supplies during a particularly harsh winter. Things eventually deteriorated to a point when the daily food ration was 5 kernels of corn per day. 5 kernels of corn per day, per person. Bradford called it the starving time in his journal. But rather than complain or despair, they gave thanks. The people banded together to support one another in worship and prayer and physical ministry to one another. And as Peter Marshall puts it in his book, The Light and the Glory, in contrast to what happened at Jamestown, not one of them died of starvation. They had a choice, either to give in to bitterness and despair or to go deeper into Christ. They chose Christ, unquote. This is an excellent book, by the way. My kids know it. They read it in homeschool. The Light and the Glory by Peter Marshall, a superb history of early America. Now, the colony would then go on to have an abundant harvest in the fall of 1623, such that they could share with the Indian tribes of the region, who brought venison and turkeys to complement the sweet potatoes, cranberries, corn, cod from the bay, goat and pigs. I'm getting hungry just talking about it. One of the colonists in his journal said, "A better country was never seen nor heard of. For here are a multitude of God's blessings." And so began the blessed tradition of the only truly American religious holiday, and that's Thanksgiving, which has its roots, too, that go further back into the temple worship of Israel, too. That's our text today. Let's look to our text today, shall we? A delightful psalm. 4 points from it. Number one, thanksgiving. Joy is ours in worship of Yahweh, verses 1 and 2. Joy is ours in worship of Yahweh. Now, Psalm 100 is the last of a brace of homage songs. Homage songs. That began with Psalm 93. Psalm 93 begins, "The Lord reigns. He is robed in majesty. Your throne is established from of old. You are from everlasting. These psalms give homage to the living God. Homage is reverence, gratitude, respect, worship, and service. All of these things represented in the psalm. And these eight psalms do just that, with Psalm 100 emphatically underlining thanksgiving. It was used regularly in temple worship, according to the rabbis. And it's a regular feature of the church's worship, too, throughout the centuries. This psalm is long and well-established. It's called the Jubilant, which translated means, "Oh, be joyful." The Jubilant has had a long history in the liturgy and worship of the church. And it also served as the basis for our prayer for silent meditation today, as you see in your bulletin. And that was found in the Apostolic Constitutions. It goes back far, far into the history of the church. And this psalm begins with an exclamation in the imperative to all the land. Might be a better translation rather than the earth. Probably indicating the land, that is Israel. The imperative to all the land to make a joyful noise to Yahweh. And look in your text, as you see in your lap, you have your text, that Lord is all caps, right? And you know by now that when you see that word Lord in all caps, it's translating the Hebrew Yahweh, which is the covenant name of God. The name that Israel was to use to refer to him. The name special and particular to Israel. And as Derek Kidner says about the joyful noise, he says, the joyful noise is not the special contribution of the tone deaf, still less of the convivial, right? Rather, the joyful noise is the equivalent in worship to the homage shout or the fanfare to a king. This is found throughout the eight psalms that we have in the 90s from 93 to here. For example, in Psalm 98, verse 6, with trumpets and the sound of the horn, make a joyful noise before the king, the Lord. Or from Psalm 95 in verse 1, O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. A joyful noise, not the special contribution of the tone deaf. Sometimes in an effort to be self-deprecating, we characterize ourselves as making a joyful noise. If we can't carry a tune, or if we don't have the voice tone of one of the three tenors, right? But that is just plain wrong. This self-deprecation is just plain wrong. We're not commanded to come into his presence with singing only if we have a fine singing voice. This bothers me. All of God's people are to sing. And those who lead should strive to encourage all the church to sing with gusto and gladness as well as skill. The singer should not be shy and self-deprecating, and the director should not be condescending. We should be more like our kids, right? Who sing with gusto, and they love to sing, and they sing what they know, right? Have that child's heart. Recapture that child's heart. That seems to be bred out of us, doesn't it? Somewhere along the way, that enthusiasm and sweet naivete of the kids as they sing, we should be more like them. My brother was a professional singer, had a beautiful, soaring voice. One of the most valuable things he taught me was when I was in one of those false self-deprecating modes and expressing it. He looked at me. He was really irritated too. He says, "Brother, don't let anybody steal your voice." I say to you today, don't let anybody, director, music director, or family relative or pastor, don't let anybody steal your voice. Sing with gusto like our kids. Don't be shy. And those who lead us, don't be condescending. The service in Serve the Lord with Gladness, that service is the service of the temple that we have before us in our text. The Levites led the land with trained voices. It's what they did, the Levites, right? But they led all the land, who in response in the courts of the temple resounded throughout the land to the music of the temple. What a beautiful thing that was. Must have seen that all the land was singing with gladness during the festivals of Israel, when the people not only filled the courts of the temple, but spilled out, overflowed into the surrounding places of the temple too. What a beautiful thing that must have been. Have you ever noticed that a genuinely thankful heart is often a joyful heart too? These two things go together. Thanksgiving and joy. It's hard to be melancholy when your heart is overflowing with thanks. Thanks and joy go together, like love and marriage, like a horse and carriage. Genuine thanks appreciates that which has been given. That something has been given in thanksgiving is implied, right? Howsoever great or small that thing may be, whether it's 5 kernels of corn or 5 tons of corn. If thankful, then joyful. And I dare say many, many Christians miss Christian joy because they neglect Christian thanks. Don't make that mistake. You wonder why there's no Christian joy in your life? Begin perhaps by being thankful. A thankful heart is a joyful heart. Thankfulness is a sign of gracefulness. From the moment of your salvation, just think for a moment about what you might be thankful for. Well, I don't have anything in my life to be thankful for, Pastor. Well, from the moment of your salvation, you have every reason to be thankful from then on, through eternity, no matter what else happens, right? When you think about it. But it's human, isn't it? It's human to sink into thanklessness and bitterness and melancholy. When we look at what others have or what we don't have, and the devil has a field day. The devil has a field day in your life. Thankfulness, genuine thankfulness leads to genuine joy, Christian joy. Well, this worship was to be an informed worship too. That brings us to point 2, verse 3. Thanksgiving. Intimate knowledge is ours in worship of Yahweh. Intimate knowledge is ours in worship of Yahweh. Know that the Lord is God. It is He who made us and we are His. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. We are to know a thing to properly worship God. He expects this knowledge to characterize us. Know that Yahweh, once again, there's that all caps Lord, which is His covenant name, Yahweh. Know that this covenant God of yours, Israel, Yahweh, is Elohim, God. And Elohim is the broader generic name. that is the creator God of the universe, used ubiquitously in the ancient world, not just by Israel. And David is saying, this Yahweh is the Elohim, the creator of all the universe, creator of all things, including the pagan nations. Now, Israel always tended to lapse into a syncretistic worship where they forgot that it was Yahweh who was Elohim. And they started treating the gods of the surrounding nations as if they were Elohim, like Baal. In the Old Testament, Kings and Chronicles and prophets would describe how the temple and its rooms were literally cluttered with idols and their accoutrements. So cluttered that one could hardly make their way through these rooms, through the temple for that matter. In fact, it was a couple of priests in Josiah's day who, in rummaging through this clutter, one day they found a Bible. They found a Bible that no one had read in years, and it started a revival. So consequently, it is imperative that we know the true Elohim, that is Yahweh, and know him intimately and personally. Knowledge in the Scriptures implies that throughout the Scriptures. This same God, Yahweh, is the very same God who is God of the New Covenant as well. He was God of the Old Covenant with Israel, and he is also the New Covenant God too, of the church. And if we know him, we will love him. We'll cling to him, and we will not lapse into idolatry. Yahweh is Elohim, the creator God who made us. And there's a double entendre there in the idea of the one who made us, the God who made us. He not only made us a la Genesis chapter 1, but he also made Israel a la Exodus 19. Made her a nation at Sinai. Made her his covenant people. He has made us. We're standing here today in the temple as Israelites, worshiping Yahweh, who is Elohim. But this same covenant God made us his people as well, the church. He made us his people, the church, at Golgotha and the empty tomb. So we can sing this same song with as much love and gusto as Israel used to, because Christ, he is God. Know this, O church. Know it to your bones, to your toenails. He has made you, not only in the Genesis 1 sense, in the garden of creation, but he also made you a new creation in that garden where the empty tomb was located. When you believe in this resurrected Christ, you believe in him for your salvation, you become a new creation, and he becomes your good shepherd. And you become a sheep of his pasture, a truly blessed one. This is essential knowledge. Know this. This is essential knowledge and must inform our worship and will prompt our hearts to thanksgiving for that matter as well. And that brings us to verse 4. Overflowing thanks. Overflowing thanks is due Yahweh in worship. You owe him your thanksgiving. Now, I could stand here all day and command the lips of thanksgiving, but the heart doesn't always follow, does it? Now, a soft heart will follow if it is open at least to appreciating that which it has been given. A soft heart can be coaxed and encouraged and trained to give thanks. So when I stop feeling sorry for myself and I take my eyes off what I don't have and I stop envying what others have, and I begin then with what I have been given, my salvation first and foremost, and everything from that is gravy. When I then begin to contemplate my salvation first and foremost, my recalcitrant heart begins to soften and sing. One of my happiest moments of being a father was one Thanksgiving day when our middle daughter, Katie, was out in the yard looking for her cat. But she was still riding high from our day of worship and Thanksgiving. And Katie was singing with all her heart, "God, all nature sings thy glory." She only remembered one verse, but she sang it over and over again as she moved about the yard looking for a cat. She was 8, 9 years old, maybe. She didn't know anybody saw or heard her, but I was sitting in the living room reading, and I couldn't help but see and listen. What a delight. She was just pouring out her heart. It was so moving and gratifying. Those of you that know Katie know exactly what I'm talking about. One of the happiest moments of being a father. And I can confirm she's passed that same heart. She's passed on that same heart for Jesus to her kids. Her kids, we had a great conversation the other day, and she said her kids are coming back now and confessing Jesus and saying how much they love him, and they sing songs and hymns now too. So how gratifying that is. Giving thanks from an overflowing heart. And when you consider this psalm and others, no wonder Israel loved the festivals. No wonder it was so hard to give up. The festivals were beautiful. The temple would be filled with fellow God-fearers from all the tribes. And the worship would be especially robust and vivacious during the festivals. The gates would be crowded with comers and the courts packed with people in full voice. What a time of joy and remembrance. What a time of joy and remembrance. A memory is necessary to Thanksgiving. A memory is necessary to Thanksgiving. If you cannot recall or you refuse to recall what you've been given, sometimes the heart is just stubborn and will not remember what has been given. And if you can't remember or recall, or you refuse to recall, your heart will remain small and bitter and pinched. This is why Israel was constantly commanded to have the law read to them, that they might never forget God's saving acts. Knowing from where you've come is necessary to knowing who you are, and also how far you've come and where you need to go. A memory is necessary to Thanksgiving, a well-rehearsed memory. Rehearse the good things that God has done in your life. Rehearse, 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 and sing, and you will find yourself having a transformed, thankful heart. It's not only necessary to us as individual Christians, but it's utterly necessary to us as Americans, too, as I think of this uniquely American religious holiday. We need to remember again. One of the reasons that America is filled with pencil-neck, man-bun, skinny-jean soy boys who join Antifa and Black Lives Matter and burn down our streets and yell America is racist is precisely because we've forgotten, because progressives have commandeered the institutions of America, especially her education. Under that scenario, Thanksgiving... What is Thanksgiving to the progressive, right? It's It's little more than a reminder that the white man stole the land from the Native Americans. And that's not to say we didn't mistreat the tribes. Part of America's judgment and punishment, I think, as well, in fact, is that we've broken covenant with the tribes we made covenant with all those years ago. But our history isn't all one of racism and stealing of the land. There is the good, there's the bad, and there's the ugly. And all of it needs to be taught again and rehearsed in the lives of Americans. When we do that, we will see the faithful covenant God at work in redemptive history. That brings us to our last point then. Point five. Thanksgiving. Covenant faithfulness is Yahweh's in our worship in verse 5. Covenant faithfulness is Yahweh's. He is always covenantly faithful. And for that we worship Him. For the Lord is good. His covenant love endures forever. Steadfast love. Wherever you see that word steadfast love, it's a small Hebrew word, but it is easily translated as covenant love. That endures forever. And His faithfulness to all generations. This last stanza, is all covenant language. The suzerain vassal covenant imposed duties and responsibilities on both parties. Both the king and the subject had responsibilities. And this stanza states that Yahweh is good and His covenant love endures forever. In fact, all of the previous, our thanksgiving, our knowledge of Yahweh, our joy, our gladness, they're all predicated on the fact of Yahweh's faithfulness. That's the reason for that little inferential preposition you see there, for. That indicates that all that follows forms the basis for all that has preceded. God's covenant faithfulness forms the solid ground, the foundation upon which our thanksgiving, knowledge, and joy and gladness in God are predicated. Has He not been faithful? Has He not been faithful? As I look out on this beautiful congregation, God's people, I know from my experience of you, you know from your experiences with one another, that God has been faithful in your lives. He's brought you this far. We're not perfect. But He has been faithful in bringing you along in His covenant. The new covenant promise has come down to you, hasn't it? That new covenant promise has come down to you from these days. One of my cousins did a history of my great-grandfather's migration from Holland to Grand Rapids, Michigan. We were all excited, anticipating what his discoveries would be. Because our family took pride, sometimes an overweening pride, in our Dutch Reformed heritage. Deacons, elders, pastors, all had come from it. But my cousin discovered an embarrassing reason for my great-grandfather's emigration from Holland. He was literally the village atheist in his hometown. And he was regularly persecuted for his lack of faith. He immigrated to America for religious freedom, all right, so he could be an atheist in peace. And he was. What you uncover, you know, what you don't expect to find in your family tree. Some bad apples in that family tree. But my grandmother did get a hold of my grandfather, and he became a believer. And God has been faithful to all generations before and since. And I dare say He's been faithful in your generations as well. Love to see the generations from my grandfather to my father and mother to us, to John and Yasika, for example, and their kids coming around. Oh, what a beautiful thing to see. God has been faithful covenantally faithful. Nationally as well, this is a different country than when it was settled, isn't it, in the colonies? Our forefathers acknowledged God's providence in their lives. The Revolutionary War. We never should have won the Revolutionary War, right? The greatest military machine in the world at the time, the British Army. We beat them. We wore them out. One preacher, Timothy Dwight, he's a pretty famous preacher from that era. He said in a sermon, "Who but must remember with hymns of the most fervent praise how God judged our enemies when we've had no might against the great company that came against us, neither knew we what to do, but our eyes were upon him." And that's true. Throughout the Revolution, you'll find that consistently across the board in the histories. "Who but must give glory to the infinite name when he calls to mind that our most important successes in almost every instance have happened when we were particularly weak and distressed." Sounds like Israel, right? "While we mark the divine hand in the illustrious event that we are now contemplating, can we fail to cry out, 'Praise the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever.'" Improbably, we went on in battle after battle to win the Revolutionary War and establish this country. But once again, we must balance that with the reality of who is glorified in all this, not just George Washington, but it was God himself, and Washington would point to God as well. One preacher, David Tappan, puts it this way: "Let us beware that we do not impute these signal divine appearances in our favor to any particular excellence in our national character. Alas, the moral face of our country," this was back in the late 18th century, "the moral face of our country effectually confutes such a vainglorious statement. Crimes of the blackest hue, countless multitudes of abominations." And he has the treatment of Indian tribes in mind here when he says that too. "Mark the visible character of this great, this highly favored community, and still provoke the great displeasure of heaven. Let us remember that, for his own sake, he hath done these great things, not for any righteousness in us, but that his own name might be exalted, that his own great designs, extending the kingdom of his son, may be carried into effect," unquote. Once again, that's a motif you find throughout the early colonial days as well. The idea that indeed we are preaching Christ, we are taking dominion of this land, and living out our Christian witness here. And we've lost that in many respects. There are still some corners. There are still the 7,000 that God has reserved for himself. So I still have hope that indeed we may recall and regain these days. But in the meantime, be faithful in your own corner of the vineyard with those plants that you have around your table, and nurture them and indeed pass that on. God is faithful to all generations, brothers and sisters. Well, let us now come to that place where we find his faithfulness to us, reprised in his body and blood, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.